Thank you for listening to Minot Today, and I want to welcome back Linda Olson. We just could not cover everything I wanted to in our last meeting, so welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
Again, Linda is a professor of studio arts at MSU. In our prior visit, we talked about her love of ceramics, among a lot of other things. And when we visited earlier, before we were even on the air, you had brought up a couple subjects that I wasn't familiar with. I wasn't familiar with the term fiber arts. And then we got off talking about rock art. And just so people understand, rock art is not paintings of Jim Morrison or Velvet Elvis. Tell us a little more about rock art.
Rock art is images that were put on the rocks, and sometimes we think by people a long time ago, but yeah, some of it is very old, like the Chauvet Cave has drawings in it that are 30,000 years old.
What's the Chauvet Cave?
Chauvet is in France.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's like an underwater entrance to it, and when they went in, they were just staggered by the beauty of the drawings that are there. You can find pictures of it online. It's C-H-A-U-V-E-T, Chauvet. And, or Lascaux, people are perhaps more familiar with those very ancient things. But even people as short a time as maybe even yesterday, although I would like to think we would learn better, have put what would be called a petroglyph on a rock because they scratched their name into it. Most of the images that I'm most interested in were put there by indigenous peoples across the world, wherever they happen to be. So every place in the world where there's available rock surface, people have decorated it in the past.
And you've talked about the art including making something out of rocks as
right.
well as, you know, when I first think of rock painting, I think of caveman paintings.
Right, cave paintings.
Yeah.
That's kind of how they've been popularized. But no, there really are different classifications of them. There are the petroglyphs, which are images that are carved or kind of like a hammer and chisel sort of arrangement into the rock. They can also be finely incised different ways. Another classification would be pictographs, which are images painted. And that's probably what we're most familiar with from the caves like Lascaux or Treffrière or the ones that we know of from France or Spain, Altamira. Those are all great places with beautiful art in them. And most of those are paintings. There's another class, they're called petroforms or geoglyphs sometimes. And there are different things that are really quite wonderful. In the desert, for example, in Nazca, Peru, the Nazca lines, they picked up dark colored rocks and moved them out. And then you see these lines that are a lighter color because there's a varnish that forms over them.
Oh.
And that's how the petroglyphs are visible too. When they're new, there's quite a bit of contrast with the background, but as they age, that kind of goes away some. So a lot of the time people will come along and they won't really even know that they're carving over something that's there from an earlier people. But back to the petroforms, petroforms were really the kind of rock art that probably was most common in North Dakota. And we still know of many of them. And occasionally a new one gets made. There's a solstice marker, kind of a medicine wheel arrangement at Valley City on the highway. If you go off and there's a little park, can't remember what it's called, but you can go out there. It's a beautiful little spot, and they have delineated the solstice times and the cross quarters and different astronomical uh-huh. features in that. So not all of them are very old. That's very well documented. Most of the petroforms in North Dakota were, and indeed most of the rock art, because the boulders were of a size that someone could pick them up and move them. They were moved when they cleared the land, or even just like smaller boulders that had an interesting image on them were moved away. One of my favorite examples of that is there's a rock that's cemented into a sidewalk in Rugby, right by the geographical center of North America.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful example of a granite petroglyph boulder. And it's been kind of mistreated, really. They are more sacred objects. They are not curiosities, but we have tended in our culture to make them curiosities. So the boulder that's there kind of cemented in, and the person that used to run a cafe that was in that little building there got tired of people coming in and asking about what that rock out there cemented in was. And she went out and she just took some brown paint and kind of painted it.
Oh, no.
If you look at it closely, you'll see that the painting of it does not really match what's underneath. So that's one problem that happens. The rock was on a hill in North Dakota somewhere, and a man was a stonemason, and he gathered stones from the hills and built churches for Bishop Ryan. And in the course of that, he had found that and brought it home to his yard because it's cool. So he saw that it was really a neat object and brought it home. And then what to do with it after he died, they didn't know. So they gave it to the city people who had it next to the geographical center, but then the road changed and they didn't know what to do, and the people were like, oh, we can have a cornerstone cafe and we'll put the rock in the corner of the sidewalk.
So, okay.
I've tried to convince people to take it out of the sidewalk and give it the due respect that it deserves.
Yeah. When you talk about this fellow built churches out of stone, I used to work with churches for a living, and there are several Episcopal churches, especially I think of here in North Dakota, that are stone built churches, very neat looking. I don't know how functional they are, but
yeah, they are beautiful. The field stone is incredible. Yeah.
I also just mentioned a little bit ago the fiber arts. Of course, young people today might be thinking fiber optics, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, fiber arts. Fibers are things like our clothes are made out of. So the fiber arts are basket making, spinning, weaving, knitting, crocheting, all of those maybe finer female arts, embroidery, cross stitch, quilting, sewing. Those are all fiber arts because you're using fabric or fibers to create something new, kind of the age-old traditional arts.
I love to see the quilting exhibit at the fairgrounds every year. There's just some awesome art there.
There is, yeah. That's wonderful to see. We really don't have to do that for clothing anymore or for decorating our homes, but those things that are made that way can be the most special.
I remember my grandma doing some quilting, and I don't think anything has survived this long, but what a great heirloom and so forth. I don't know if you know Chelsea Dietert, but she has the Quilting Academy.
Oh, yes. Town. Okay.
She's been a guest on the show, too, and she teaches that art, and that's the way I'm always going to refer to it, as an art.
Yeah, it has become an art, and there are people who take that, like, to the nth degree in the art world, creating art quilts that rival any painting that you might see in a traditional gallery setting.
Absolutely. And Linda, we haven't talked much about background, but you know, I feel all art is a reflection of the greatest artist there is, the one who created everything. Some of the stuff I see just makes me think, that's amazing. Tell me a little bit more about your love of ceramics. What actually spurred that on? Was it, you know, just tell me a little about that.
I think it fits my personality. You know, I'm a pretty down-to-earth person. And if you're going to do ceramics, you can't be the kind of woman that wears a lot of makeup and little high heels. And I've always been pretty practical. So I think that's maybe part of why that's where I found my home in ceramics. It also is a very exciting medium in that you can do so much with it. And today in our world, there are so many ways that you can find out what people are doing. If you just start watching Pinterest or Instagram and even just Googling things online, you can find amazing examples. So I think that's part of it that I'm attracted to, because I don't always have a very long attention span. I need to be learning things and growing. So because of that, a medium where I can try different things and I can develop a high level of professionalism doing this style of pot, but then also come back and do this raku pot, that's always been attractive to me.
Let me ask you this, as a somewhat of a treasure hunter. I used to have a gallery in Underwood. I don't think I ever had a display of ceramic art. That would have been really cool to have. But if I was out in an auction or something, I would look for Rosemead and maybe some other brands. Now, let's take something by Rosemead. That's probably all mass manufactured. How do you know if you're looking at something that may be of value, aside from it having personal value that you look at it and you like it?
That's always the best, though. Yeah. I would recommend you never purchase art because you think it's an investment. If it turns out to be an investment, that's great, but your first priority should always be toward that you enjoy it. Sometimes those things were mass produced. Other times there's more handiwork in them. there's a fine line there, and I guess rarity does make things more valuable, and sometimes that age does. But there, the School of Mines at UND did made pottery that has become quite valuable.
That's neat, you know, that it made locally here and of value. Yeah. And I mentioned the Rosemead, but there were others, and it's been so long, I don't remember the names. But
right. Well, the cable years at UND were very exemplary for putting people to work, and they did it in a variety of ways, and it's all valid to me. It doesn't matter. I mean, like slip casting something, I've been working on a series of cups that are, I call them sustainability cups, where I take a plastic cup and I slip cast it, and then I make a mold from the plastic cup and I slip cast porcelain cups from it, because I like that sort of idea of taking something that's very transient and not good for our environment and then hopefully turning into something that's a little better for our environment because you can reuse it. And they've been quite popular. So I don't think that it's a technique that you use to make it that makes it more valuable or less valuable. It's just kind of a different angle on it.
Let's, for my benefit, explain the difference between ceramics and pottery.
Well, pottery is a part of ceramics.
Okay.
And ceramics includes that wider world. All hot media, even things like glass, the space shuttle's tiles were ceramic. So, you know, they were fired very hot, and that's what allowed the space shuttle to come back to Earth without burning up. So, you know, there's a whole lot of industrial ceramics that don't quite fit. But the pottery is usually people who are making pots for us to use. Eating utensils, dish sets, those kinds of things. That's usually the pottery aspect of it. So the sculptures, there are hundreds of people out there doing ceramics now that don't make pottery but make sculptures.
What is my key holder on the wall there?
Don't know. That's cool.
Obviously, people can't see this on the radio, but I have this round thing that looks like the sun with his hands out, and he holds keys. And I have no idea where it came from or how I got it or anything, but it's one of those things I just couldn't throw away because I thought it was so cool. It does seem to be ceramic, though, right?
Or plaster. It might be plaster.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah. One of the two.
And when you talk about the durability of ceramic, again, talking on the industrial end of things, you mentioned the space shuttle, but 100 years ago, that was what every home's drain tile was made out of. Your sewer tiles were made out of that.
Yeah.
And they're only now in say, this decade or whatever, starting to collapse and so forth.
Right. So very durable.
100 years under the ground.
And that was an industry making the plumbing things. There's a wonderful historic clay district in Medicine Hat, Alberta. If you ever go to Canada, it's a wonderful place to visit because they did that there. They made those kind of drain pipes and just different utilitarian things that were used in houses, but also the crock industry, you know, and there were places like that in every region because everybody needed them. You know, the one that people are probably most familiar with is the Red Wing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I used Red to work Wing. For an auctioneer, and man, we loved getting Red Wing crocks.
Right. Yeah. And they're very collectible. But in Medulta, they actually still use the old ceramics things to produce today. So they're made with a mold. It's a jollying technique is what it's called.
Wow.
You take the clay and you have a sort of a thing that presses it down, and you keep adding and pressing it down around it. So sometimes you can see, if you look closely at them, the traces of how it was made.
Yeah.
So, but it was a mold process, and that's how you standardized, and you'd push the clay into it, and then you'd give that mold some time to withdraw a little water from the clay body, and then it would separate easily, and you'd have your standard crock size.
Oh, neat. Linda, I can't believe we've already run out of time again. And again, I think we could keep going, but we have to stop for today. So again, thanks for being my guest here on My Not Today on KHRT.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you once again for listening in to My Not Today on KHRT Radio. I hope you'll tune in next week when we have Savannah Young, the assistant manager of the Souris Valley Saber Dogs. Please listen in. Thank you.